For WHUS Stores, I'm Dori Smith, filling in for Richard Sherman, who's away at a media conference. Today, part two of an interview taped May 11th with independent reporter Dar Jamail in Jordan, where he was analyzing reports about a new U.S. offensive in Iraq called Operation Matador. The U.S. has been targeting cities and villages along the Euphrates River and at the Syrian border, where it's feared more Iraqi civilians are being killed and more homes destroyed. Dar Jamail has reported from Iraq for Free Speech Radio News, Pacifica, and numerous publications. His webpage is darjamailiraq.com. Because a Connecticut bill on depleted uranium passed in the State House of Representatives, I asked Dar to talk about depleted uranium first.
Yeah, this is a very important situation, and I'm really glad that you brought it up, actually, because the fact that depleted uranium is being used in Iraq on a daily basis, and so many hundreds of tons have been used already, is affecting Iraqi civilians severely, and U.S. soldiers. So many U.S. soldiers have died as a result of exposure to depleted uranium during the 91 Gulf War already, and we even have reports now of soldiers coming home from this conflict already suffering from radiation exposure. And then if we look at what's happened on the ground in Iraq regarding the civilian population, dreadfully high increases of cancer rates throughout southern and central Iraq, particularly now in central Iraq, where with this invasion and this war in particular, there was so much depleted uranium used. We have child cancer really across the board, and I can't tell you how many people I've run into in Baghdad who, for example, their wife has breast cancer, or their wife had pregnancy difficulties because of what they suspect to be exposure to depleted uranium. Just really, it's rampant there. Everyone knows someone who has some type of cancer or has suffered from the effects of this. And when soldiers continue to come home now and suffer these effects, and more of this information gets out, we're going to look at a situation where there is going to be some forced accountability to the military and the Bush administration for using these illegal weapons, because essentially there's more radiation in Iraq now as a result of hundreds of tons of depleted uranium munitions being used, more radiation in Iraq now than in both atomic weapons used in Japan at the end of World War II. And people aren't aware of this. It's really one of the biggest stories to come out of Iraq, but also one of the most underreported. And we're looking at a situation now where we have a very large amount of Iraq has been irradiated and is going to remain that way. Well, the half-life of DU is 4.5 billion years. So this situation is not going to go away, especially when we consider the fact that the U.S. has 14 military bases there, 140,000 troops there. It's really a despicable idea to even consider that the government, who these soldiers, these people joined the military to serve their country, for whatever reason they joined is really irrelevant. The bottom line is that they sign an oath to serve their country and to follow the orders that they are given, essentially giving their total trust and allegiance over to a government that they're sworn to protect, and trusting that this is a government that's not going to launch a war unless it's absolutely necessary, a government that they would assume is going to take care of them, give them health benefits, compensate their family if they are killed, this sort of thing, and certainly make political decisions, theoretically, using war only as a last resort. We have an administration in the U.S. now that has been extremely flippant with how it goes to war. We have two ongoing wars, and we have soldiers coming back in body bags and extremely wounded from both of these conflicts on a daily basis almost. And we have a government now that is not compensating them adequately in the health sector regarding depleted uranium. Yes, now families who lose a soldier in battle are being compensated better, but as far as health benefits and actual pay for soldiers on the ground in Iraq, We have not seen improvement in the fact that they're not being taken care of for being exposed by some of the own weapons that they're being given to use is really ludicrous. It's I don't understand how anyone can't be completely outraged at the U.S. government's not only reluctance, but basically choice to just not really look into this and try to alleviate the problem. Instead, we have this administration that touts being patriotic and supporting the troops and trying to appeal to people to be that way, and yet here we have yet another instance of them not only making decisions without the welfare of the soldiers in mind as far as launching a war for completely unjustified reasons, where we've already lost 1,600 soldiers because of these lies, but then is very reluctant to simply not even look into the effects of the types of munitions that they're giving the soldiers to use.
Journalist Dar Jamail wrote about depleted uranium weapons use in Iraq during the 8 months he was reporting from Iraq. The Connecticut House Bill 6008, which just passed with massive support in the state, provides Connecticut GIs who served in the Persian Gulf War or designated combat zone Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom with the right to testing on or after October 1st, 2006. This testing is supposed to be, quote, best practice health screening test for uranium poisoning. There is some debate on the floor right now about just what that is. Hundreds of thousands of U.S. veterans are on disability after serving in the Gulf War. There are also effects of depleted uranium showing up in veterans of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. There's a good deal of anger about the fact that these weapons were used at all in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Depleted uranium weapons use is illegal under international law. The U.S. government was not forthcoming in admitting that it was being used during the invasion and occupation of Iraq. The U.S. military denied using DU weapons, even as they were being delivered by A-10 Warthogs flying out of Connecticut bases. Representative Rob Simmons was asked whether or not the U.S. was using DU in the Iraq war zone at a forum on Iraq in May of 2003. He said it was not being used and that it was his understanding that it was illegal, but that he would look into it. That kind of response has frustrated activists on the DU issue, who have taken it upon themselves to find massive documentation about the types of weapons in use, the nature of the radioactive materials used on those weapons, and the locations in war zones that have been made toxic by depleted uranium use in Iraq and Afghanistan. Scientific experts and groups like Veterans for Peace now hope state lawmakers might come to accept all of the information at their disposal, and they say they're more than willing to provide it. But for now, House Bill 6008 is bogged down in funding assessments and ongoing discussions about who should pay and which agencies should take responsibility. Doctors, scientists, and veteran groups studying DU say they have no problem identifying the kinds of testing needed or how to define which soldiers should be tested. All of them, they say. Soldiers being deployed should have a baseline test. And since depleted uranium was so heavily used in Iraq and other places, they point out that everyone should be screened for DU exposure. The money from the federal government is there, they say. They urge Connecticut lawmakers to move as fast as humanly possible to put this bill in practice. These advocates turned to the states because they were being stonewalled by the federal government. A basic urine screening offered to troops was only minimally effective. Soldiers may have been told that they were not exposed or not at risk, when in fact they do need treatment. State and federal lawmakers and members of the military and federal government will have to work together on this emergency, since the military has to provide information on the locations where DU weapons were used. They do have that information, according to an intake worker at the Connecticut VA. A clerk in the Appropriations Committee said lawmakers expressed concern about long delays in providing testing. Amendments are under consideration. A healthcare worker at the Veterans Affairs Office said a PTSD education awareness effort had paid off and soldiers were now coming forward to be treated for that condition. She hopes the same kind of public information process will occur about depleted uranium. Independent journalist Dar Jamail spoke with us May 11th from Jordan, where he was taking a look at the increase in violence during Operation Matador and a sharp increase in bombings by the resistance in Iraq. Dar has done more than most reporters to cover the resistance and try to define who they are and what they're fighting for. I asked him to characterize the Iraqi resistance, those called insurgents and terrorists by the Pentagon and U.S. press, though Donald Rumsfeld has been pretty cagey about defining what he means when he talks about Iraqi insurgents.
Well, Mr. Rumsfeld is very reluctant to talk about what actually comprises the Iraqi resistance because it would automatically, if he was going to be truthful about it at all, it would debunk the myth being perpetuated by the Bush administration and the mainstream media that the Iraqi resistance is Saddam holdouts and foreign fighters and terrorists, because the reality is, conservatively, 90% of the Iraqi resistance is composed of Iraqis themselves. Yes, there is a bit of a Ba'athist element, but more and more, today more than ever, the majority of the resistance seem to be more common Iraqis who are taking up arms to defend their homes from occupation forces. They don't want their homes to be raided. They don't want to be detained. They don't want their cities being occupied. And then also a primary recruitment tool being provided by the U.S. military in Iraq is so many Iraqis have been killed, injured, or humiliated under the occupation that their family members are then forced to take up arms to bring revenge for the family and so as not to dishonor their family. So again, the Iraqi resistance is composed mostly of Iraqis. Some are ex-military, some are Ba'athists, but more and more now it is average Iraqis who are fighting primarily for nationalistic reasons.
The reports are saying that 1,000 U.S. military personnel have been sent to this Syrian front. That doesn't seem like very many fighters, does it?
It doesn't, probably at first glance, but really if we look this at this region, it's extremely sparsely populated. There's not many people there to begin with. We're talking about Al-Qaim being a very, very small town. So it's not even near in the League of Fallujah, where they really did require over 10,000 soldiers to go carry out that operation. So it's such a small area. There's hardly anyone there. It really is literally desert. It is on the banks of the Euphrates, but there's just not much there. So if we have 1,000 people for extremely sparsely populated area, backed up with tanks and helicopters and jet fighters, then it is actually rather a large force if we look at what they were trying to accomplish.
Again, the goal is said to be security in Iraq, but what do you think some of the other goals are as to this region as you see the U.S. military planning over the coming years and how things will look with new U.S. military bases and perhaps a new structure for the country itself in terms of where different types of power is located? That I mean, different types of control over oil, different types of political control. This is all developing now as a backdrop to this violence, Dar Jamail.
Well, for starters, it should be important to note that the of course the U.S. Senate just passed the bill with $82 billion more to be spent mostly in support of the ongoing operation of Iraq as well as Afghanistan. And this funding is going to be used primarily to continue the construction of what are going to be 14 permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. We already have 4 that are now set in Basra, Baghdad, Aruba, and in Erbil, and 10 more in the works. So there is going to be this continued military presence in Iraq. They do want a military footprint in the Middle East, and Iraq is it. That offers them great access to Iran and Syria and possibly Egypt in the future. So that is going to be the fact. The U.S. does need the oil in Iraq. They don't have enough enough soldiers there to really provide adequate security for Iraqi civilians or the pipeline. So we are simply going to see a situation much like Afghanistan, where their goal is really not to bring total stability and security to Iraq. Instead, it's to have bases located in strategic positions near oil facilities, as the U.S. does have in Iraq now. And I think we're going to see this continue indefinitely at this point. They're really, the Bush administration has been reluctant to put a timetable of withdrawal there because they really don't have plans for a complete withdrawal. Certainly, they would like to have the number of troops in Iraq lessened, but they really don't have plans for a full withdrawal. And this is certainly evident when we look at what happens in the on the ground there with the bases. And as far as political ramifications, we have a situation where the U.S. now is put itself in a position where they have to maintain a puppet regime in Iraq, because if they give any legitimate government there full sovereignty, the first thing that government will do in order to honestly reflect the will of the Iraqi people is to demand an immediate timetable for withdrawal. And until that's why we will see that never happen, because of course the U.S. can't do that. As the saying, which has become common at least among me and some of my other colleagues, is the U.S. has to get out of Iraq. They want to get out, but they can't get out.
Let's turn to some of what the U.S. military spokespersons are saying also. We have U.S. Marine Captain Jeffrey Poole saying that soldiers have built a pontoon bridge across the Euphrates River and that Marines had pushed into the northern Jazeera Desert. They're calling this a largely unpatrolled area near the Syrian border. Just continuing on here, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, a spokesperson for the U.S. forces in Iraq, told AP also Monday, "This is an area which we believe has been pretty heavy with foreign insurgents from many different areas, Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Palestine." Touch on those two comments from U.S. military personnel.
Well, one reason they say this is basically a remote area and they haven't patrolled there much is because there's no people there. It's essentially desert once you get away from the Euphrates. There's just a couple of very, very extremely tiny villages of composed not more than 100 families. And there simply has been no need for them to patrol there, which is why they haven't. And now they are once again, just as they have said themselves, conducting these military sweeps through these areas. Again, there are a couple of small groups of fighters there that have been causing them very many problems in recent months. We've seen Al-Qaeda in the news before. This is also an area where a wedding party a ways back was bombed by U.S. helicopters, causing many, many deaths. The military continued to deny to the end that this was anything but a wedding party. They said this was a terrorist safe house and this sort of thing. And again, what we're seeing now is a situation where the people in that area have turned against the U.S. military because of military actions there in the past when they've gone after a small group of fighters. And now we see an area that is suffering collective punishment as a result of the fighters being there. So the entire city of Al-Qaeda and many of the villages in the surrounding area are being swept by the military. So we're going to see this continue probably for at least another day, because again, it will be a situation like Fallujah, where the second the U.S. military leaves that area, what fighters were there will simply return.
Dar Jamail, you covered the elections in Iraq. Have you done any research into the newly appointed leaders of Iraq, and talk a little bit about what is now starting to become more of the trend of thinking about who will be leading the country?
Well, the first thing before discussing this, it should be noted that this new Iraqi government really doesn't have any autonomy. It is not sovereign. They have not called for a withdrawal timetable from the U.S. government for their forces in Iraq, because the U.S. does not want them to and cannot afford to have them do this, despite the fact that this is the main reason that Iraqis who did participate in the elections on January 30 voted, is they wanted a government that would step in to power and immediately demand a timetable and start to end this brutal occupation that the country is suffering under. So we can see very clearly that this is a puppet government. It cannot make any decision on its own without U.S. approval. And then it should also be noted that every ministry in Iraq has a U.S.-appointed advisor serving a five-year term. That said, some of the people in the current government, again, we have people like Ahmed Chalabi, very, very corrupt individuals, and then other people like Abdel Mahdi, who have very, very strong links to the U.S., and particularly to U.S. oil companies. These people simply attached themselves into the Unified Iraqi Alliance list, which was the main list of candidates that did get the majority of votes under the elections. Ahmed Chalabi and Abdel Mahdi, both being Shia, for example, are members of this list. So simply because they were in that list means they do have automatic representation in the National Assembly, but that doesn't even mean that people actually voted for them as individuals. So just to give you an idea of how this thing worked. But as far as the government really having power or how this is going to play out into the future, I should say, is it's going to be the U.S. government has put itself in a very interesting position because, for example, Jafari, who has is with the Dawa Party, the Shia Dawa Party, of course, has extremely strong links with Iran. How this plays out in the future is going to be very interesting, if, for example, with what will happen in Iraq if the U.S. does take any military action or greenlights Israel to take any military action in Iran. We're likely to see very severe consequences in Iraq. And then we're already starting to see some friction between the current government as it does try to get a little bit of sovereignty for itself from the U.S. government. For example, just yesterday it was reported that the current government was having problems with the U.S. government and that they did not want the CIA so involved as acting in as the Secret Service in Iraq. And the CIA, of course, did not want to turn that power over to the Iraqi government. So some of the Shia members, particularly in the leading party with the most representation, said, well, okay, we'll just create our own Secret Service then. And they have commenced in doing so, in direct contradiction to what the U.S. government wants. So there are ongoing conflicts already between this government as it tries to wrestle some legitimate power from the U.S. forces in the region.
Ibrahim al-Jafari again being the new prime minister of Iraq, at least for now, until elections may change things. Let's just go through this list and you can tell us what you know. President Jalal Talabani.
Yes, Jalal Talabani actually is someone who really is not representative of too many Iraqis. This is an individual who he's Kurdish, but that said, he does act sort of as a dictator over basically half of Kurdistan. And this is an individual who, in fact, came up and shook Saddam Hussein's hand after the gassing of the Kurds in Halabja. So you can imagine the type of response this individual gets or what type of popular support he has from actual Kurds in the government as he tries to make actions. And the reality is, with his position, it is simply a ceremonial position that he actually doesn't even wield any actual power.
Moving to Vice President Ghazi Al-Yawar.
Ghazi Al-Yawar is a Sunni, and he, of course, is there, again, as a bit of a political figurehead, because it does look good on paper to have an actual Sunni in something that appears to be a high-ranking position, but his position is yet again more or less ceremonial, since the Sunni essentially did boycott the elections. He has lost much of the popular support he had when he first came to power in the interim government, and now he is basically disenfranchised in the new government since the Sunni did boycott the elections. So most Sunni don't really view him as being a representative of what they want, because if they did, then he wouldn't even be an active member in the government.
And Vice President Adil Abdel Mahdi.
Well, Abdel Mahdi, we have talked about him a bit. He has very strong links with oil companies in the U.S. He travels frequently to the U.S., has been in Washington, D.C. quite a bit. He meets with Condoleezza Rice from time to time, and is a very good puppet at the end of the day for the Bush administration. He is in very strong support of privatizing Iraq's oil infrastructure, rather than having a nationalized oil infrastructure. He is in support of privatizing it, and specifically to opening it to U.S. firms, because he will cash in on this, and he is basically going to be using his position in the government to try to make that happen, even though it is, of course, totally contradictory to the wishes of the union oil, the oil unions in Iraq, as well as the Iraqi people.
Dar Jamil, final thoughts on the political climate in Iraq as far as who is emerging into power. We did hear that some people were really falling out of power.
Well, the situation is that the Iraqi government is so transient and really is under such scrutiny by the Iraqi population, and people there in the government know this, and they know that essentially they're not even going to exist in Iraq without U.S. backing, support, and by essentially operating in the green zone, which is where they have all of their meetings. So anyone who does decide to pull out of this government, such as Adnan Pachachi in the past, they immediately have to exit the country for their own safety and for the safety of their families. And we are starting to see people resign. What few Sunni were in the government, several of them did resign recently. And I think over time, we're going to continue to see this escalate, especially now as the wrangling about the Constitution begins, which hasn't even really begun yet. And that's going to be the real test of how functional this government is, and if there is any hope to be placed in it for improving the situation on the ground in Iraq, is if they do come to some agreements on some of their irreconcilable differences.
You testified in Italy at tribunals on Iraq, talking about some of the legal questions and ramifications of the U.S. foreign policy there, which was a preemptive strike, really, based on weapons of mass destruction that were not there. You've also talked about the role of the media. Just touch a little bit on this subject of the criminality of this war and how you see that as very important right now to what is going on in Iraq in terms of the violence.
Well, essentially every day the U.S. occupation continues in Iraq is a violation of international law. We have now a war that was launched on lies. We see all of the reasons given for this illegal war having been proven debunked very, very clearly. No links with Iraq and what happened on 9/11, no weapons of mass destruction. This certainly was not about liberating the Iraqi people. It was simply about establishing a military presence in Iraq. And so every day this occupation continues is a violation of international law. Every day this occupation continues, things are happening on the ground where civilians are dying, their homes are being destroyed, or they're suffering casualties of loved ones and wounds and humiliation, like being detained and put in Abu Ghraib. The torture situation is ongoing. All of this, of course, is against international law. We have illegal weapons continuing to be used in Iraq. We have cluster bombs being used in both sieges of Fallujah. We have depleted uranium continuing to be used, sometimes on a daily basis, all of which, of course, are violations of international law. And this is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much else to report.
Dar Jamil, you are now reporting again from the Middle East. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your plans and talk about where you are now?
Well, I am reporting right now from Amman, Jordan. I will be in this region for at least a couple of months now. I'm going to do stories about how the Iraq situation is affecting other countries such as Jordan and Syria. I do intend to go to Syria as well, report on what's happening with Iraqi refugees in both these countries as well as other developments. And then I will be going to Turkey, to Istanbul at the end of June for the culminating session of the World Tribunal in Iraq in order to testify about some of the things I've witnessed in Iraq.
Thanks so much for this important update on developments in Iraq, and we look forward to talking with you again as things unfold.
Well, thanks again for having me, Dori.
I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores. For further information, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com.